Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Keith Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Rockfin or Rumble or wherever, listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate the support. We know you've got a lot of options out there. If you want to connect with me directly, the website is macroaggressions.io. You can find everything there is to know about the books I've written and the podcasts that I do and all that good stuff. Huge thanks to our sponsors. They make the show happen. Chemical Free Body has been with me from the very beginning. They make supplements that actually work. What an idea. What a great place to start. You can get a green 85 canister. I drink that every single morning. It's just powder. You mix it with water, 12 ounces, you're done. Easy. No hassles there. If you want to incorporate the detox bundle into that, I suggest it. I've done it on two different occasions. It's a 90-day program. It's the Green 85 drink plus gut detox, toxin detox, ultra enzymes, probiotics. They all come in capsule form. You just take a handful of those in the morning and you're done. And you do that for 90 days and you will see the results. I had tremendous results. So I'll tell you what, best thing to do, go to chemicalfreebody.com, read up about it, see what you think. If you find something that you like, the promo code on your way out is macro, and that will save you some money. And also a big thanks to our sponsors at Legal Shield. They have been doing this for a half a century in the United States and Canada, and they'll get you access to a high-powered attorney in your area for a very reasonable amount. How reasonable? $30 a month. That'll get you in the door. You can get them to knock out all of the documentation that you need. Do you have a last will and testament? Do you have a financial power of attorney? You got to have that stuff. And nobody wants to spend a couple $1,000 on an attorney to do that. So why don't you do this? Why don't you take a look and maybe have it done through Legal Shield? Your attorney can knock that out for you in the first month of your membership. I would do that. Do this, actually. Go to the website that they made specific for this show, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com, and take a look and see what you think. They've got all kinds of items you can add on, a la carte features that you can add to it, like a ID shield or a small business plan if you run that, run a small business if you're somebody that carries a gun. They have documentation for things like that as well. So there's a lot going on over there. The best thing to do is just read, see what you think. If it's right for you, pull the trigger. If not, that's cool. No big deal. The website, don'tgetpushedaround.com, is the place to go to find that. Well, now that the business is out of the way, we can get down to the fun part. I was at Liberty on the Rocks the first week of December 2023. And after the presentation was over, I had conversations with the people that were in attendance, and they were fantastic and really smart. And they said, "Have you heard of Robert Gore? Have you heard of Robert Gore? You need to get into his stuff." So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, author Robert Gore. How are you, Robert? Good to see you. What's going on?
Good to see you, Charlie.
Well, as soon as they mentioned your, you know, as soon as they told me to go to straightlinelogic.com, your website, the following morning I did that after my talk at Liberty on the Rocks, and then it made sense to me. I understand why they were sending me your way. It's very reasonable and very logical, as the name might indicate, and very necessary in this time of great uncertainty and chaos, especially with regard to how the media treats us. How in the world did you even get started in this line of craziness?
Well, I think it was like 2010, something like that. I was working for a securities firm. I ran the fixed income division out in Los Angeles. And once a week, we did a broadcast for the rest of the firm. We had several branches and whatnot. And they started letting me opine, get up there, and my version of the world, and so on and so forth. And people started asking me, gee, that was good. Can we get a copy? So after a year or two of that, I thought, you know, maybe I'll start a website. And this first website was really, really primitive or whatnot. And I basically had to send out emails to tell people where it was, that I had done a piece, that I had done an article. 2014, we had moved from California out to New Mexico. And I decided to upgrade the whole thing. And that's when I put it on the site that you saw, the WordPress site. And it did pretty well. I was surprised. I went from, you know, maybe 50 to 100 people to, you know, quickly over 1,000. And then from there, some years are better than others. But, you know, I have a consistent and loyal following. So
I met him. Yes, I know.
I did a presentation for Liberty on the Rocks. I think that was, God, I can't even tell you when it was, maybe 5-6 years ago. They're a good group.
But your background is really kind of hardcore finance, yeah?
My background is hardcore finance, even when I was doing hardcore finance, I was writing. I think I published my first book in like 1990, first novel. Second novel was 2013. That's kind of a magnum opus, the golden pinnacle. First volume of a trilogy. I had a couple of...
I've got the second one of the Gray Radiance.
That just came out. In the interim, just for fun, I wrote a satire of the Middle East called Prime Deceit. Actually, it's a satire of Syria. And I also wrote the only business book and probably the only memoir, not really a memoir, but anything personal. Everything I know about business, I learned from The Godfather.
Perfect.
So I've done that. I'm also the CEO of a high-tech company, a spraying company.
I saw that. That's an interesting product. It's such a simple thing that you guys have kind of revolutionized the art of charged injected precision spraying. It was a concept I was unfamiliar with until you sent me the website. Then I took a look at it and I thought, oh. It sounds like some engineers play around with this, and they found a way to build a better mousetrap for painting cars and spraying crops and aerosol products and all that good stuff, huh?
Yeah, and I'm the only non-engineer / scientist in the firm. I'm a CEO, but my particular skills, I have a law degree too, kind of come in handy, and we're getting to the point finally where it's ready to take off. Our CTO is probably one of the 20th smartest people on the planet. He invented all this stuff. He has 20 patents, 100 papers. He's 90 years old, sharp as a tack. Like I said, now we're ready to take off. So it might take away some time from the writing and the blogging and all that.
I'll put the link to the spraying website in the show notes as well. So for those of you listening, you want to go take a look, you just drop down in there and find it and see what you think. It's such an interesting path though to get from, I just got back from Anarchapulco, and you talk about a group of people that are interested in building a better mousetrap or building a whole different system altogether. So I came back and took a look at your spraying company, and I thought, well, you probably could have been at Anarchapulco talking to people about it. There would have been a lot of people that would say, I like this. I like the way that your mind works. You're looking at this from a whole different way. I mistakenly didn't think there was a whole lot of room for improvements in how you spray things in that technology, but of course I was wrong on that one. Leave it up to your 90-year-old genius partner there to still come up with new ideas for how to do these things right. Is that where things are going for you? Is that going to be your main sort of line of work from this point?
Since I've grown up, I have never been able to concentrate just on one thing exclusively, and shut out everything else. I have to have 2, 3, 4 things going at the same time. So, yeah it'll take more time. We're maybe negotiating agreements and so on and so forth. But, if somebody said, oh, you've got to do this, 12 hours a day and then go to sleep and stuff, I just couldn't do it.
No. I hear you. I'm pretty much the same way. Go ahead.
That anarcho deal that you're talking about, that sounds really interesting.
It was the 10th anniversary of the event. And I wrote a book with Jeff Berwick, who runs a company called the Dollar Vigilante. It's now become there's the Crypto Vigilante. And one of the side projects he has, speaking of a guy that can't do anything for 12 hours straight without wanting to do a million other things, he came up with this idea that have a conference for all of these anarchists. And if you think about the idea of a conference with anarchists, that doesn't necessarily go well together at first glance. But when you get around this group, it is most definitely. And since I was the ringleader of it this year, it was like, make all these anarchists not go over into that section over there, but instead stay over here. I'm looking at the producer going, are you kidding me? You think I can make these people do anything they don't want to do themselves? But
you know what anarchy is?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. But through this event, and I've been coming for the last couple of years, I've met the most interesting people in the world. There's a lot of things to complain about when you look around and you see the modern world. And if it were just about complaining, I would have a PhD in that for sure. But it's nice to meet people that then say, all right, we've got a problem. How do we fix it? We don't need the system necessarily. Let's see if we can build something outside of the system. Let's see if we can build something that looks and functions much better than the existing structure. And therefore we'll peel away people from that. I'm not even necessarily selling them on my idea. We're just going to do it differently. And if you're interested, come join us. And that kind of meeting people like that internationally too, they're from all over the world that show up at this conference. That is very inspiring because I get the feeling that there are a lot of smart people that are on this that I'm, and also a sense of community too. You're not the only one that feels like you're losing your mind out there when you take a look around at the world. So I come back, I always come back from that conference very inspired, but also a little bit down because I feel like, oh God, I'm coming back to the real world and all the things associated with that. So maybe we'll listen. It's Mexico in February. How bad can that be? You know what I mean? Yeah. So there's at the bare minimum, you get that. But right before I left for that trip, I read one of your articles and it really caught my attention. And I just wrote down the term because I knew I wanted to talk to you about it. And the term is controlled instability. And I thought, oh, the arrogance of the governments, that they think that they can create instability and yet manage it for their own purposes and in a way that won't have any sort of blowback or escape or anything like that. That we're just going to make things kind of bad, but we'll keep a lid on it, and then we'll use the kind of badness to give us the sort of power that the justification to do the things that we've always wanted to do, but we won't let it get too bad, right? Oh, that arrogance just infuriates me. And when I read your article, I knew I wanted to talk to you about that. Can we just kind of explore this concept of controlled instability and how a government gets to a point where they start believing their own bullshit?
Well, governments have always believed their own bullshit. There's a self-selection thing that goes on. If you don't believe the bullshit, you're probably either going to be expelled from the government, executed, or you just never joined in the first place, which right. is what most of us who don't believe the bullshit do, is we shun government, we shun politics. But we have a historical arc here, emerging from the Reformation, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, was a consolidation and a belief in government. You had to have governments. Everybody had to have governments. You were leaving kind of, you could almost call it anarchy of the Middle Ages. And you were building these massive governments, and you were building empires. And that was the way it was for the next 400 or 500 years. I think probably the apex of all that, and this comes through in the latest novel, is August 9th, 1945. The U.S. detonated the second atomic bomb. We were literally at the top of the world. We still had an intact military. We had suffered the smallest number of casualties of any of the major combatants in World War II. We had an intact industrial plant. And now we had the atomic bomb. We were the only country to have that. That probably is what historians looking back will say, this was peak empire. Mm. Okay, because when you're that high up, being an ex-trader, you reach a point in market where markets have nowhere to go but the opposite direction. Everybody's on board. The boat is listing one way. So same thing with empires. So 1949, the Soviet Union detonates a bomb, and that was kind of, the beginning of the downtrend in empire, the whole idea. And over the next 20, 30 years, all sorts of important technological developments happened. You got this amazing concentration of computing power and communications power. You got the U.S. entering war after war after war after engagement that they didn't win. Vietnam should have been a huge signal. You can invade countries. You can do this. You can have your dreams of empire, but not everybody buys into it. And what was really interesting is the fact that you had these barefoot people in pajamas with maybe an AK-47 or whatnot. And we bombed the living crap out of them. We napalmed them. We did this, that, and the other thing, and we still lost. Yeah. That should have been a signal. The other thing that I'll say should have been a big signal, 1991, the Soviet Union, probably the most repressive, most powerful, most non-liberty dedicated government in the history of man, just collapsed. okay? And this whole centralized dream collapsed with it. And that, in and of itself, should have started a massive intellectual reevaluation of the way things actually were versus the way a lot of these intellectuals thought they should be. Yeah. And instead we got a, you know, end of history, what we have now, a liberal democracy, I guess is what they called it, is the end state, the goal of human existence, so on and so forth. Kind of ignored something that our founding fathers knew in their bones. Governments are inherently corrupt. Okay, they're never going to recognize that, hey, we have a good thing here. The American government in 1991 had a pretty good thing. Let's expand our powers. Let's diminish the powers of the people. Let's collect our taxes. Let's just keep piling on. And there's nothing really unusual about it. I mean, you wrote a book about empires, you know. And so, but 1991 was another watershed. And it was kind of a point of panic for the military, industrial, and I'm going to add the intelligence complex. If you don't have the USSR, where's your enemy?
Yeah.
So you go create one. Islamicism. 9/11. We all know what happened after that. I'm not going to fill in all the blanks on that. We'd be here for several hours. But you could see more and more power resources shifted to that sector of the economy, of course, at the expense of the rest of us or whatnot. So controlled instability is an oxymoron. And particularly with the decentralization and the individualization of technologies, of beliefs, you know, it seems like nowadays everybody has their own religion, you know, and I put that in the latest novel, too. You have that. You have more and more what I've called entropic atomization, okay, which is entropy, tendency toward random disorder. Atomization speaks for itself. And it's getting harder and harder to control these forces. And when I first started talking about this, say, you know, maybe 10 years ago, skepticism, what the hell are you talking about? But nowadays I say controlled instability. Okay, well, 2016, a guy who wasn't supposed to win the election won the election. The country that wasn't supposed to leave the EU left the EU. They spent the next 4 years trying to bring down the guy who wasn't supposed to win the election, and it failed. 2020 comes up, and we have a flu bug that supposedly threatens the world, and we're going to scare the crap out of everybody and make them take vaccines and lock down and so on and so forth. I mean, all of this craziness keeps, you know, and it just keeps right on going. 2022, Russia invades Ukraine. 2023, Hamas flies over the walls of Gaza, attacks Israel. Israel attacks with, you know, multiple of force that Hamas employed. You probably could have gotten really good odds if way back in 2015 you'd said, okay, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. And people would have said, no way. And you say, okay, I'll put up a dollar and you can pay me $500 if it does. And people would have probably taken that bet. So it's not just something that you project out in the future, you look at the present and say, oh, my God. And you know, that was the point of this article. It's happening. And it's just, it's going to keep happening. And I know there's this groups who think that they're going to institute pure totalitarianism and whatnot. I have trouble believing that's the way it's going to happen or accepting any of that.
And now I feel the same way. This is, you know, it sort of gave me a little bit of hope in that when we went through the COVID era, I think a lot of people saw just how really incompetent the government is. And there's this belief when we're kids that daddy government is going to fix everything and they've got it all under control and very smart people that are very well established know what they're doing and they're running it. Maybe that was the case back when Reagan was in the office when I was a kid and I saw him and I thought it looks stable. And now everything feels completely disjointed. And after COVID, the mask came off and even people that never asked any questions are looking around, they're saying, you want me to stand on a dot that's 6 feet away from another person while the person who's in line to the side of me is only 2 feet away? You want me to stand on this dot before I get on an airplane and sit with somebody 4 inches on either side of me? This doesn't even make any sense. And that realization that sometimes, for a lot of the normie people that have just come to this conclusion, sometimes the government isn't exactly honest with you about things.
Well, say and, so.
And I wonder if looking back on this, as we get, you know, years down the road, we look back on this and in some way look at the COVID situation and say, might have been one of the best things that ever happened. It woke up a huge percentage of the population to the lies of government, the overreach, the authoritarian leanings of them. Of course, a lot of people are going to be hurt from it. It'll never really be a good thing. But in terms of opening people's eyes to this, whether it's JFK or 9/11 or COVID, when you have these big transformational events that you are not allowed to question, you're only allowed to feel one particular way about it. Isn't it just sort of human nature for a percentage of the people to just go, well, I want to feel differently about it simply because you want me to feel a certain way, right?
Exactly. And I saw it on a personal level. My sister's a doctor. Got all the shots, the boosters, so on and so forth. And when all this started, I said, Judy, explain to me how a face mask that is anywhere from 100 to 1,000 micron mesh is going to stop a 10 micron virus. Oh, just shut up and put on your mask. Okay, fine. What was it? Two and a half years ago, get a call early in the morning from my mom. She had been vaccinated twice. And for the previous, from the vaccination to the 3 or 4 months, her blood pressure was going absolutely crazy. Couldn't figure it out. Anyway, get a call from her. This is terrible. I'm in really bad shape. I called my brother who lives close to her. I said, get an ambulance for mom. The drivers got there. Her heart rate was 10 beats a minute. They said, this woman is going to die. She was gray. They got her to the emergency room, managed to resuscitate her, but she was in ICU for 4 or 5 days. Turned out she had a string of pulmonary embolisms. Now, later on, this was still fairly early on, but later on it came out pulmonary embolisms is a huge marker for vaccine injury. I mean, right. I read somewhere, I think it was 840 times more likely to get them if you've had the vaccine than if you haven't. And then my brother got an extremely rare form of bladder cancer. It's the only one where you automatically take out the bladder. That's the only treatment for it. And it's extremely aggressive. He's still with us, but obviously his quality of life. Okay, so now my sister's a little bit more willing, to say the least, to listen to what I and other people have to say about potential vaccine. And you know, I'm not a scientist, but you try to approach these things scientifically. But, you know, the evidence is the evidence. And so like you're saying, you know, maybe it takes that much to open some people's eyes, but at least eyes are getting opened.
Yeah. Well, but you've sort of shown a propensity towards seeing things before they happen. And I'm interested in talking to you about you calling the housing bust in 2006. And one of the main reasons why I'm interested in talking to you about that is because living in Las Vegas, working for big builders at the time, Pulte Del Webb at one point, Centex, which was later bought by Pulte Del Webb, and then finally Lennar, in new home sales. And I was watching this happen. I was living in Las Vegas. I was selling homes. I owned a home. I bought another home. As you know, I kept the smaller one as an investment property, moved into the bigger one, and all that good stuff. I was right in the middle of it, and I couldn't see it. And part of the reason why I couldn't see it, and you can maybe relate to this being a Southern California guy like I am, in my mind, the argument I could make was, well, it's still a third of the price of Southern California, and it's 4 hours away, and there's no state income tax, and there's plenty of reasons to always have this pipeline of people coming from Southern California. Hell, I did, and I know plenty of other people who did, and therefore, my reasoning was, even if things get worse, you know, even if things kind of, it might just flatten out a little bit. And I was dead wrong about that, obviously. And it started me down this path. The same time this was happening in 2007, I'm reading John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, about how the IMF and World Bank start to loan to own. You know, they set up a system where the loan was never really designed to pencil out. It was almost a trap to get you to fall behind in your payments, and then they extract something of actual value from you. I'm reading this on a dive boat in Thailand, and I'm going, oh my God. This is us, but on a smaller scale. We're doing this. We're giving loans to people that have no business buying a house. We're approving them. We're packaging them up. They sell them off to Wall Street and they're gone. I was in it for many, many years. I had a vested interest in understanding it, and I couldn't understand it. How come you could understand it in a way that I couldn't understand it even while I was working in it?
Well, it may have been because I wasn't in real estate per se. What I was in was in finance and securities. And my method of trading securities is like almost simplicity itself. When everybody's bullish, I try to be bearish. When everybody's bearish, I try to be bullish. And I was living in Southern California, as you said. We had a very nice house. It was between Bel Air and Beverly Hills, or excuse me, yeah, but it was that the price of the house just was going up like $100,000 a month there for a while, and I said this. I know a market. I don't know a lot about real estate, but I know markets. And I know a market that looks like it's getting ready to top. This is what happens with crazy stocks, with rallies that last too long, so on and so forth. The other thing I was looking at was the back end. They were taking all these garbage mortgages from people who could barely sign their name and were getting, you know, 100% mortgages, 120%. The kind of stuff, I don't know if you saw the movie The Big Short, but the kind of stuff they made fun of.
Well, that was like a documentary for me, watching The Big Short.
And then there was just some good fortune. The house right across the street from us, came open as a rental. I said, let's sell our house. Let's rent a house across the street. And I think we'll do okay. And we had only bought the house because we had a son coming in. We needed a place, a bigger place to live than where we were. We were renting. The rest is kind of history. We sold the house in, I think, January of 06. The market kept going up for, you know, you never call anything for top tick. I learned that. But then it started to falter. And I remember when we put the house on the market, got this really, really nasty note in our mailbox from somebody. It wasn't signed. Why are you selling your house? You idiot. Blah, 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 blah. Are you going to bring? And it's like, you know, what do you care? Okay, right. Go hold on to your house. So, yeah, we sold the house. The other thing I did, I really, looking at the structure of finance, all this garbage securities were all over the world. And I thought, you know, I thought way back then, hey, the world is way over indebted. You start pulling this string and it's just going to be like an old sweater that comes unraveled. I said, the whole financial system. So I set up a proprietary trading desk where I was working at the time, a regional securities firm, a private firm. And we set up a prime broker relationship with Morgan Stanley, essentially to make short bets on a whole bunch of stuff. And it didn't work out at first, but then it worked out really well. And I had a really, really bright guy who, Columbia MBA or whatnot. And he understood credit default swaps and he had traded them. So we went out and bought a bunch of credit default swaps on things like AIG, Merrill Lynch, a whole bunch of them. And God, you'd walk in some mornings and you'd, the only problem was we set up that prime brokerage with Morgan Stanley. And after Lehman Brothers went bust, we're like, oh my God, Morgan Stanley's in about the same shape. I mean, they all were, you know. And we said, we better get our money and our positions out of Morgan Stanley. And we did. And so we lost quite a bit of the upside. And, you know, Morgan Stanley got help from the government and got bailed out. So we didn't need to take the money out, but we didn't know that at the time. And I, you know, I didn't have the political connections to know who was going to get bailed out and who wasn't.
No, I think that was a smart move on your part. You would have had, I mean, because nobody, we didn't know that Lehman Brothers was going to be forced to walk the plank. I mean, nobody liked Dick Fuld, of course, but you know, then nobody likes Jamie Dimon either. They're still around. So maybe, I wasn't really sure how the politics were going to go. But once one of them went, it was reasonable to assume that they might, you know, that a few more might have fallen. So you were doing what they were doing in The Big Short, right? They were
on a mini level. Yeah. I mean, we had nowhere near the exposure, but yes. And if I were so inclined, I'd be doing the exact same thing today.
That was my next question is you see this current paradigm that we're in. We've got, 33 plus trillion dollars of debt. It's getting piled on like crazy. There's no appetite to address the southern border. In fact, there seems to be an appetite to keep it the way it is for a variety of reasons. We've got banks that feel very, volatile. We've got an overheated housing market, interest rates at 7% now up, tripling over the last couple of years. You've got a magic wand. You've got a big bag of money. How are you? You're at the craps table. Are you betting on the guy with the dice? Are you betting against the house? How are you? How would you be positioning yourself in this scenario?
I'd be betting against the house. I would be, and the reason I'm not doing it is because I'm doing all this other stuff like being a CEO or whatnot. And this kind of trading is not for amateurs. You have no idea the pressure it puts you under, even when your bets are winning. In fact, for some people, for me, the winning. I always said there's two types of traders. Traders who can't go to sleep when they're losing money and traders who can't go to sleep when they're making money. I could always sleep through the losses. But man, when you know, when it's piling up or whatnot, you're not sleeping. You're not communicating with people. You're just like in cloud cuckoo land or whatnot. You're checking the screen every 30 seconds to see just how much more money you're making or whatnot. So I'm not engaging in this now, and I'm not giving investment advice, but you ask me if I were engaging what I do, I'd be short stocks. I would be short bonds. I would be long CDS. I would be long gold and silver. There really isn't as much correlation between precious metals and market turmoil as you might believe. And a guy who's done a ton of empirical work on that is Robert Prechter, who I can't recommend highly enough for anybody who really wants to trade markets. Elliott Wave International. Who was...
Okay. So, gold and silver.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, we were leveraged. The world was leveraged big time in 2008. We're much more leveraged now. And when you start, okay, you mentioned the $33 trillion in debt. That's just the tip of the iceberg. You've got at least $200 trillion in unfunded pension and Medicare promises. That's just in this country. Now, every country in Europe and China has similar levels of debt. Surprisingly, the one country that I think will emerge pretty well off if we do have a global financial crash will be Russia. They have like 30% debt to GDP ratio. They're sitting on a ton of natural resources that are, you know, always going to be a bid. And then you get into derivatives.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, there's like 7 or 8 major derivative dealers in the world. You're a derivative dealer. You're going to do what's called matchbook. If you sell a derivative that goes up in a certain market, you're going to sell another derivative to somebody else that goes down so that you balance out. And normally it works fine. You take a little bit, the spread on both sides and the money's good. What happens?
You're a bookie. You're a sports bookie, but for
a bookie.
Right.
Okay. You're a bookie, but now all of a sudden you've got somebody who's placed a really big bet and they've lost it to you. And maybe you laid off your liability on the other side, but the person who placed a really big bet can't pay. So now you're not matched up. And this is what happened with Lehman. This is why things cascaded after Lehman, because Lehman was a big dealer in this, but now it's a counterparty on all these trades.
Right.
It can't pay. The whole thing goes kablooey, and it goes kablooey in a hurry. That's a technical term, by the way, kablooey.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yes. Well, we're going to hear more of it in the coming years, fortunately. Okay.
They don't even know how many derivatives are out there. A derivative is just something whose price is derived from the price of something else. So futures are derivatives, credit default swaps, all these are derivatives. They have no idea. But a lot of them are off the books. But the estimates are anywhere from 1 to 3 quadrillion, which is which is 1,000 trillions. Okay, the whole global GDP is 85 trillion. So you've got anywhere from 12 to 25 times the global GDP in these derivatives. When that starts unraveling, Katie, bar the door.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got, let's say that you're on the right side of on the winning side of a derivatives trade. Doesn't really matter if the person that's on the losing side of the derivatives trade has no money and can't pay you, right? I mean, if you're technically the winner, but you can't collect from them, so then their financial situation becomes your problem as a result of, right? So if you've got Lehman, or if, we'll put it in today's standards, let's say you've got Deutsche Bank sitting over there as a zombie with a huge derivative book and a lot of exposure to all kinds of crazy things. You may be a well-capitalized, forward-thinking, logical, reasonable bank. But if you're doing business with that person, they're going to infect you with their stupidity, right? Is that going to ultimately impact you regardless?
I'll tell you a story from the last financial crisis. AIG, big insurance company, they decided that there was no credit risk in the world so that they could sell credit default swaps, which is essentially assurance against a credit blowing up. They thought, okay, we can sell these and it's just an easy source of money. You know, there's no risk on the other side. They didn't bother to even offset their risks. They just wrote these naked credit default swaps. Well, okay, things start happening. Who did they sell all those naked credit default swaps to? Goldman Sachs.
Oh, boy.
So now Goldman Sachs is holding all these credit default swaps. They're big winners, except AIG can't pay. Okay, what did they do? Well, guess who was Secretary of the Treasury? Hank Paulson.
Hank Paulson.
Yep, formerly of Goldman Sachs. Now, Goldman Sachs, this is just hubris and greed. Instead of just saying, okay, well, why don't you pay us something, reimburse us for our losses, they got paid 100% on the dollar for all those credit default swaps. I mean, you got an entire country who is looking at foreclosure and mortgages and everything, all these regular people, but Goldman Sachs is getting paid 100% on the dollar. So
it helps to know the guy. whether it's John Corzine or whether it's Hank Paulson or whether it's you name your banker Larry Summers, any of these guys, if you know the guy who's in charge of making the money decisions, you just say, well, our bank, if we were to go out of business, think of how bad it would be for all these other people, right? Wink, wink. And then next thing you know, you've got $700 billion immediately to stop I forget what Hank Paulson called it, a civil war or something like that. Blood on the streets. I don't know.
But, yeah.
What a threat. I mean, you back to your Godfather book, government, organized crime. What's the difference really? Right.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, the only real difference is, you know, the government guys wear Gucci's and stuff, and the Godfather guys, who knows what they wear, but probably not Gucci's.
I think I'd much rather have the Italian mafia running the government than the current incarnation that we have, if for no other reason that I at least am of the belief that there is some sort of code of ethics with the Italian mafia. Maybe I'm mistaken, but at least they try to keep innocent people out of the way. It seems like the American government takes pleasure and joy in destroying the hopes and dreams of the American people. If not, I mean, they certainly are good at it and have had quite a bit of practice over the years. How does this thing... You've seen some cycles. How bad does this get? As we're here and we're sort of the beginning part of 2024, we've got an election at the tail end of the year. We've got elections all over the world, frankly. We've got farmers in Europe that are mad. We've got homeowners that can't pay for groceries. We've got a lot of things lining up. We have a president that can't find his way off the stage, and another president that's been called everything, including the next coming of Adolf Hitler. So where do we go? It feels like there's periods of my life where it was relatively calm, maybe even a little bit boring. And then there's certain years where it feels like everything gets condensed into that. And for whatever reason, I know I'm not alone. A lot of people have been feeling like 2024 is the year where everything kind of comes to a head. What is your take on how this thing sort of plays out for the rest of the year?
Right now, I would say we are collectively, obviously, there's individuals who see things closer to reality than others. But right now, collectively, it feels like we're children and their parents digging sandcastles on the beach, with the tsunami rolling in. And obviously calling it a tsunami, it's going to roll over them and a lot of people are going to drown and die and so on and so forth. I was dumbfounded in 2009. I thought, you know, you went through all this pain. Let it wash through the system. Let these companies go bankrupt. Let's recalibrate things. Let's start over. We'll then have a foundation. Yeah, it's going to be ugly, but if this is just another can-kicking exercise, then the next one's going to be that much worse. And I thought, realistically, I thought, you know, I don't think they can save this system. And I think it was pretty close to unraveling. Then the Fed, you know, started pouring money into the system. The banking regulators told the banks they no longer had to mark their assets to market. They could dream up whatever valuation so that they wouldn't be showing these gargantuan losses. All sorts of things happened. Plus, you kind of had the natural end of a bear market after all this or whatnot. And, you know, that's the flip side of selling at the top is, and Prechter got that one right. He got both sides of that one right. He's got a lot of things right through the years, but anyway. And if anything, I stayed too long on the bearish side, gave back a fair amount of what we'd made on the bullish side. You know, psychology is psychology. I just didn't see how it was going to work out. It did work out kind of, sort of, or whatnot. Just like things kind of worked out in 2020 when the market crashed after COVID. And, you know, I gave everybody money. Yeah, you can do all that. My feeling this time, and I could be wrong, is there's going to be no rescue from the tsunami that's heading. You know, central banks can print all the funny money they want, this, that, and the other thing or whatnot. But this time we get a complete washout.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the tsunami, because when Berwick and I wrote Controlled Demolition, we ended with that. We ended with December 26, 2004, Banda Aceh, Indonesia, when the people went out to the beach after the big earthquake and what was going to become later that day a massive tsunami. They went to the beach and there was no water. They didn't know what to, they had never seen anything quite like that. Where there used to be water, the water was gone. And they had to recalibrate their brains to make this calculation. Now, the people that had been there, that the older people that had been around, or the animals also instinctively knew to get to higher ground. And we kind of made that comparison to, well, you're on the beach, there's no water. What do you want to do? You want to take selfies out there and call your friends and tell them how crazy it is that you've come to the beach and there's no water? Or do you know what this means when there's no water? You've got to know there is a reckoning. It didn't just vanish. It's coming back, and it's coming back.
A vortex, and yes.
Is that the sort of the problem that we face currently, is that we're looking out at the beach and we're saying, there's no water. We know what this means. And yet the general public is out there trying to rationalize it or explain, well, if there's, you know, just maybe someone will come and bail me out. Someone will come with a helicopter and save me from the, there's no, you're saying there's no helicopters coming. There's no magic bus that's going to show up and load everybody and get them to higher ground. It's figured out now, or pay the consequences.
Yeah. And, you know, you have to take care of yourself and your family and hopefully some of your friends and whatnot. Tell them what you know. Some of them will listen. Some of them won't. Yeah, what you said, get to higher ground, you know, get the hell away from the beach, and hope that you get to a high enough point.
Well, I don't know if you have it on your calendar, but it's false flag season, apparently. And I wonder, you've seen a fair share of government fuckery in the way of false flags and doing things that aren't exactly not exactly in line with how you'd want to treat your population if you were a benevolent government. So as we get into this, is this something to keep an eye open to with regard? We've got obviously what's happening in Ukraine and Russia. That's been 2 years now. We're going into the third year of that. We've got what's going on in Israel, Gaza, that area, which is now spreading into the Red Sea. You did some nice writing about that. We've got, we hear about Taiwan and China. Nothing really feels like it's happening there yet, thankfully, but are we in a position where if this war is going to start, somebody better kick it off themselves, right? And that's usually done with a false flag, something that is made to look a certain way or pin the blame on a certain group when in actuality it's not. Given your history of understanding and seeing things before they develop, is there anything in particular we should be watching, or maybe some geographical region that we should be keeping our eyes on?
False flags for me have generally been something that I don't predict. I look back on them and say, boy, that sure looks like a false flag after they happen. The one thing that I think will kind of perhaps obviate the necessity of a false flag from these people's minds. And I've never believed that financial markets, by and large, are nearly as controlled by conspiratorial forces as a lot of people do. I think they're governed mostly by crowd psychology. I never used to pay any attention to the Fed, the central banks, the $500,000 a year commentators who keep offering explanations for what markets did and predictions that rarely turn out to be right about what they're going to do, and then tell you why after the fact. But I think we're on the cusp of a financial crash, a global sort of thing, or at least a Western sort of thing. I think Asia, China, Russia, those countries will do far better in all this. For one thing, they actually still produce things. They have minerals. China and Russia have been stockpiling gold for years and years. The people are smart. They're industrious. Lots of Americans are too, lots of people in the West, but that's not who's running things here. So
we have an opportunity for this BRICS Plus consortium to provide a real balance, a check on power of the current, I don't know, West, I guess we could describe it. Is this something that's a net positive for us? I mean, I don't like the idea of any sort of empires, but, and I could see the forming of something, maybe the beginnings of that through the BRICS, but at the very least, it would be nice to have somebody to check what the West is doing, this rampant criminality with indiscriminate wars and the things like that. So is that the check on power that maybe the Soviet Union was back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, or 80s, whatever. And now, as you mentioned, in 91, it goes away. There's no longer a boogeyman. Could the BRICS consortium become the new boogeyman?
Well, I think the people running our show would like it to be. In reality, I mean, two things you can say about the BRICS, what you just talked about. It's something different. It's replacing the faltering empire with what they call multipolarity. Obviously, at the top of this multipolarity thing is Russia and China. Russia, we're the ones with 800 military bases out there. I don't believe either Russia or China really has a lot of offensive designs. I don't think that they're trying to replace an American empire with their own. So that being said, on the other hand, you know, they're governments. And I instinctively and inherently don't trust governments any stripe. Do I trust Vladimir Putin? No, but I thought he was well worth listening to on that interview with Tucker Carlson. Same thing with Xi Jinping. When he opens his mouth, when he writes, you ought to pay attention. You've got to pay attention to China. You've got to pay attention to Russia. You've got to pay attention to these newly emerging BRICS, you know, who they're incorporating in and whatnot. It's a confederated sort of thing. I think it's a different structure and a different philosophy than the U.S. empire. But you better well understand it, because I think, you know, they're going to be driving a lot of the horses here the next probably till the end of this century.
And they've got a lot of gold.
They've got a lot of gold. They've got a lot of productive power. They've got 7/8 of the world's population. They've got huge mineral resources, everything else. And they have a lot of people who have historically been poor and starving, which is where your entrepreneurial classes come from. You look at just what the Chinese do, both in China and when they go overseas, the Indians, what they're doing in India, and what they do when they come to this country. That's what propels things. That's progress. These are the people that determine history, not the rulers, not the politicians or whatnot, but, you know, how much freedom does the average person have? And you give the average person freedom and they'll do amazing things. I mean, that's our own history.
Well, let's wrap up with this, because I have a question from one author to another with The Gray Radiance. How do you write dialogue that's 100 years old? My goodness. 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, you get this dialogue in a way you weren't around for that. I mean, you weren't listening to this, and yet you feel like I feel like I was the Duran family, which is probably a amalgamation of some other wealthy families. But how I've only written nonfiction. I've never created characters. The characters I write about are cartoonish enough, the Rothschilds and Rockefellers and people like that. How do you write dialogue for this?
For fiction writers, well, for both fiction and nonfiction writers, the internet is the best friend. You can pull up videos that talk about slang, talk about how people talked back then. I seem to remember like every conversation I had with my mother's father, my grandfather, and he was an itinerant minor. I think he had like a fifth grade education, something like that. You know, you got to back out all the politically incorrect terms that he used, which I did by and large. But that was great. And I don't know, I used to read a lot of history, and I just had kind of an ear for picking up on that thing. My proofreader said the same thing about the dialogue. So I guess the dialogue strikes true with people.
Yeah. Well, for those that are looking for a good book to pick up, The Gray Radiance by Robert Gore is available on at Amazon.
It's on Amazon, yeah.
Amazon?
Yeah. Both and Kindle and paperback.
Kindle and paperback. And, I mentioned straightlinelogic.com as the website. That's a good place, I would assume, for people to go. Otherwise, they might be able to catch your writings. I catch it in Zero Hedge from time to time. Whenever I find an article, I'll read it and I'll look and I have to double check, make sure your name is not there, because a lot of times I the headline grabs me and I read it. It's either you or Brandon Smith from Alt Market. I see this stuff and I go, I knew it was one of them. So where is the best place for people to find you and to support your work?
Well, Zero Hedge just lifts my stuff straight off of Straight Line Logic. Straight Line Logic is the place to go. And right now, I have two featured articles, the controlled instability right there on the front page, the homepage, and right under it, is a description of the Gray Radiance plus the first chapter. There's also links to all my books there. So, yeah, I would start with Straight Line Logic. And I feature a lot of different writers. I'm not the only guy up on Straight Line Logic. I'm putting up, you know, anywhere from 10 to 15 articles a day. Just this is, you know, stuff I agree with or stuff that's particularly provocative, or sometimes it's just well written. There are some really great writers out there on the internet.
There are.
You know, and even sometimes when I don't agree 100% with anybody I post. So
it's tough to these days. There's there's too much going on for, and frankly, not required. You know, I don't need.
This is the alternative media. This is what it's supposed to be. All sorts of intellectual ferment. This is the intellectual bastion in this country. I mean, you know, I haven't read mainstream media for years and years now. And I've been one of the biggest promoters of alternative media. In fact, that was the subject of that Liberty on the Rocks presentation I gave.
Well, I'm really glad they turned me on to your work, because you know how that goes. Once you can be unaware of somebody, and then once they get on your radar, then you start to see them everywhere. I don't know how that works. Maybe your mind is a little bit more attuned to it. Maybe it's the universe. Who knows? Maybe it's the Gray Radiance. That's Robert Gore, everybody. Check out his work. Support him. Buy his book. I'll have all the links in the description below so that it'll be easy for you to click it. And if you want to connect with me, the website to do that is macroaggressions.io. I'll talk to you again soon. Thanks, everybody.